It is Monday, February 29th, Universal Time. It is a leap year, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, our national correspondent gives us a look at the prospects for the leading Republican and Democratic presidential contenders the day before they face the biggest test from voters so far. Our financial reporter explains why the U.S. stock market had a relatively good performance in February. A reporter from VOA's Persian service will tell us how Iran's moderates and conservatives fared in Friday's elections. And VOA's correspondent at the Oscars tells me what it was like to be backstage at Hollywood's biggest awards show. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, we've got one day to go before Republican and Democratic voters in 11 U.S. states will make their preferences known for who they want to represent their parties in November's presidential election. I spoke earlier with our national correspondent, Jim Malone, who's been following the opinion polls ahead of the Super Tuesday contests, and I started by asking him about the state of the race on the Republican side.
The polls in the Super Tuesday states give Donald Trump a pretty good advantage. There's one state we're watching closely, which is Texas. That's the home state of one of Trump's rivals, Ted Cruz. Cruz is ahead in the latest polls, but it's close. But in most of the others, Donald Trump has anywhere from single-digit to double-digit leads, so he is positioned to do quite well on Super Tuesday.
And what is the strategy that Trump's main rivals are employing to try to close some of those gaps?
I would call it the kitchen sink strategy. They're trying to throw everything at him at this point. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, is trying to go after Trump over the issue of why he won't completely distance himself from supportive comments made by a former Grand Dragon in the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, for example.
Which is a white supremacist group.
Yes, and Rubio says this is disqualifying. Now, Trump says he's already said he disavows that support from Duke, but he's been pressed in media interviews, and there's been some interpretation as to whether he's gone far enough to distance himself from those comments. But in the case of Ted Cruz, it's a situation where he says we don't know what kind of president Donald Trump would be. And in fact, he questions whether he's even a real conservative. So the attacks on Trump from his rivals are really stepping up.
They've escalated.
And the party establishment is showing quite a bit of concern. Ben Sasse, a Nebraska senator, said he can't vote for Trump. So there are signs on one hand that there's great distress in the party, but then you have the endorsements by Chris Christie and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. So he's making some headway on the other side.
Now, do you think it's too late for some of these attacks on Trump to significantly affect the outcome? What is your feeling about that?
I would like to see what happens in terms of the question about the KKK supportive comments. Let's see if that has any impact on the voting on Tuesday. I would be watching that. But, you know, we've raised these issues so many times before with Donald Trump about supposedly outrageous comments that are made. Will they turn off his supporters? And we've seen no sign of it.
They didn't hurt him too much in the past. Other controversies that he's waded into.
Right.
How about the Democrats? We've got Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton seems to have the momentum right now. So how can we expect them to do on Tuesday?
I think because there are several southern states voting with large populations of African-American Democrats, that's going to help her quite a bit. I'm talking about states like Georgia, Arkansas, Tennessee, Virginia. She will probably do pretty well in those states, as she did in South Carolina on Saturday, where she really walloped Bernie Sanders. So Sanders has some concerns there. He's focused on states like Minnesota and Massachusetts, where the black voting bloc is less important.
And he has some leads in certain states?
It's close. It's close in Massachusetts, I would say. It's competitive. And Minnesota's a caucus state. We always have difficulty trying to divine in advance what's going to happen there. So he may be close in a few places. He could have a few breakthroughs. But she may wind up getting the lion's share of the delegates on Tuesday.
Which is what matters.
And that'll just add to that perception that she's the front runner and well ahead.
Well, thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, up next, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with us in the studio to talk about the online reaction to our top story. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So let's begin with Donald Trump, since he's the one dominating the polls, right?
Absolutely. He received his first Senate endorsement Sunday from Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, like Jim mentioned earlier. But on Monday, another Republican senator, Ben Sasse from Nebraska, said he will not support Trump. He shared an open letter to Trump supporters on Facebook.
And what did that letter say?
So it's quite long, but let me just read some snippets from it. He wrote, "I sincerely hope we select one of the other GOP candidates. But if Donald Trump ends up as a GOP nominee, conservatives will need to find a third option." He also wrote, "Mr. Trump's relentless focus on dividing Americans and tearing down rather than building back up this glorious nation."
Well, Donald Trump does often express how much love he has for so many people, but of course, other people think he's dividing. So what about this controversy with David Duke? He is a very prominent American who is a white supremacist.
Yeah, he's prominent. So Trump appeared on television Monday and said he didn't get to disavow former Ku Klux Klan leader the day before because he couldn't hear very well. He blamed a faulty earpiece. Now it all makes sense. He just couldn't hear. And here's what he said verbatim. "I am sitting in a house in Florida with a very bad earpiece that they gave me. And you can hardly hear what he's saying." So during Sunday's interview with CNN, Trump declined repeated invitations from the interviewer to criticize the white supremacist group and its leader.
Looks like he's just content, Donald Trump, to disavow like he's done on Twitter. So let's move on to the Democratic side. What are Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders saying?
So Clinton tweeted an image that said, "I believe in love and kindness." And this is very much in line with what many people have urged her to do, to be more personable. But the replies to that tweet were rather interesting, this time judging her for being too fluffy. One user asked sarcastically, "I wonder if she believes in babies and puppies." Hashtag mindless rhetoric. You can't win, right? Mm-hmm. Her rival Bernie Sanders began using a new hashtag, by the way, hashtag Super Monday, in preparation for tomorrow. He wrote, "Our most important task is to revitalize American democracy. When we do that, we change America." That's all for me today, Michael.
Let's see if it works for Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much for that wrap-up, G. You can follow G on Twitter at GAbbyLee. And I'm on there as well. My handle is at Michael_Lippin. And our program is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
You've heard of hybrid vehicles. Now comes hybrid planes. The UK-based budget airline EasyJet says it will begin trials of a passenger plane that uses a hydrogen fuel cell to taxi on the runway. Ian Davies is head of engineering with EasyJet.
We pulled together a kind of basic idea around, could we use a hydrogen fuel cell to power our aircraft now while they're on the ground?
EasyJet says it could save around 50,000 tons of carbon-producing fuel each year simply by using the hydrogen fuel cell prior to takeoff. Davies says the technology is already being used in vehicles like Toyota's Mirai.
We think we'll need around 150 kilowatt generator, which exists today in buses. And I thought, well, if we can power a car and a bus, surely we can power enough of the aircraft during the turnaround.
The hydrogen fuel cell will power motors in the plane's wheels, and the only waste product is water. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. We've come to the end of another trading month on Wall Street, and the main Dow Jones Industrial Average managed to make a slight gain for February. I asked our markets reporter Jill Malandrino in New York, what was the main factor behind the market's improved performance this month?
February was pretty impressive for the bulls. The S&P and Dow were actually up marginally for the year. The NASDAQ, the only major indice that is falling a bit behind, just about 1%. But it really was an impressive rally considering stocks were absolutely plummeted in January 2016. A big part of the participation is due to financials and the energy sector rebounding. It feels as if it's less panicky than it might have been in January when the S&P was trading in correlation with the crude oil trade. But fundamentals still remain challenged. Traders that I speak with believe that the market is diverging a bit from the oil trade, but because of the velocity of the rally that we saw in February, there is a little bit of caution out there. You have to remember, in bull markets, to see the pace of the uptrend that we saw just in a small time period for the month of February, that's really not conducive of a slow and steady bull market run. So there is a little bit of uncertainty still out there until we get more stability in the banks, till we see more stability in the fundamentals and the technical trading of oil.
Can you elaborate a bit on the oil price situation? Oil prices have been generally weak but rebounding, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, and that is why we've seen a rebound in the S&P. But at the end of the day, fundamentals still remain stretched. They still remain weak. We are still producing at record levels. There have been no actual cuts put in place, whether by OPEC or non-OPEC. So for right now, traders believe this might be more of a technical balance, almost a relief bounce, because there is less panic in the oil market. But in terms of an actual fundamental improvement where we've either seen production come offline or production cuts being made, that hasn't occurred yet.
Right. And of course, oil companies and energy stocks do benefit when the oil price rebounds. Mm-hmm. Now, in the month of March, what are investors going to be looking out for?
Well, the first week of every month is the most important, because we get the employment report every Friday, the first Friday of every month. It's also called non-farm payrolls or the employment situation report. This is the most key piece of data on any given month, because it largely impacts the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. It's a comprehensive report on how many people are looking for jobs, how many have jobs, what are they getting paid, how many hours are they working. There's a big difference when you're creating more part-time jobs versus full-time jobs, and are hourly rates actually increasing, because that translates into consumer spending power. The trends for the employment reports have been largely positive, but this month is even more important, because on March 15th and 16th, we have the Federal Reserve meeting and the interest rate decision on that Wednesday, followed by Federal Reserve Chair Yellen's press conference. Recall back in December, we had our first rate hike in almost 10 years, and we saw the volatility that followed in the back half of December and the beginning of January. So the Fed is especially sensitive to market movements right now. And based on what the employment report tells the Fed on Friday, we could really come back into a situation where potentially we could see another interest rate hike in March if they believe this data is strong enough. Now, the market isn't pricing in an interest rate hike, so because there's so many ifs and whats, that's where we're getting a lot of this uncertainty still in the market. So I think until we get past this on Friday and past the meeting on March 15th and 16th, we'll be in this choppy, trendless trade.
And then we'll have a better idea of whether we will, in fact, get a rate hike. Thank you so much to our markets reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino.
Okay, thank you so much. I'll talk to you next week.
Well, turning to Iran, candidates running under the reformist and moderate conservative banners have won a majority of seats in the Iranian parliament and the Assembly of Experts. Iranians went to the polls to fill both bodies on Friday. Arash Sagarchi is a reporter with VOA's Persian service, and my colleague Susan Yaki asked him what stood out in the Iranian election results.
We had the two elections in Iran on Friday. The first one was the election for parliament. All 30 seats for Tehran, the capital city, now were elected just reformist. And in the entire country, more than half are reformist and moderate. That is a big change in recent 12 years because, you know, for 12 years, the conservatives, they had a parliament, they had a government, and since 2013, a lot of change happened in Iran. Also, the election of Assembly of Experts at the same time was in Iran, and that was very important. The result shows moderates got win too.
So what does this mean for the nation, really?
Actually, Hassan Rouhani, the president, needed this parliament. The current parliament is a mix of conservatives and also extremists in Iran. So it can help Rouhani to make, you know, a better economy in Iran. Also, some expect to have more freedom by this parliament, of course. Frankly, more free law can be set by this parliament. We hear from a lady was elected from Tehran yesterday. She said the hijab is not mandatory. And this is new for many Iranians to hear that from a parliament member.
Well, does this reflect a major change in the attitude of the whole nation towards the West?
It should be. You know, right now, foreign policy is in supreme leader's hand. And but in the parliament, it means you will hear less, actually. You will hear less against the West from the new parliament member. 3 months ago, when Iran deal was considered in Iranian parliament, many extremists chanted death to U.S. and they were against the deal. But right now, many of them, they are not right now in the parliament for next parliament. And also, since next June, when the new members get the office, the parliament attitude will be more soft with Western countries.
Well, let me ask you this. The Supreme Leader, will this in any way change his positions on anything?
No, the Supreme Leader, no, there is no expectation to change his situation. But, you know, I think he was angry to this big change. Like last presidential election, many people believe that he is not angry to give power to moderates. But maybe he thought moderates can have a better deal and negotiation with West.
And that was reporter Arash Sigarchi of VOA's Persian service speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, it's time for a look at Hollywood's 88th Annual Academy Awards, or Oscars. Our West Coast correspondent Mike O'Sullivan was pretty lucky. He got to be there backstage as the winners spoke to the press right after picking up their awards. I asked him what it was like to experience that.
Well, you know, it's always interesting because there are always some surprises. And the winners, when they come back, you'd think that a lot of these actors who have been around for years are a little bit jaded, but when they come back, somebody like Leonardo DiCaprio wins an Oscar, in this case his first Oscar on his sixth nomination, people are just really excited. I mean, this is it's an important honor. It's recognition by the Hollywood movie industry, the key people, you know, recognition by peers, fellow actors and actresses, directors and writers and so on. So this is really the most important accolade that someone in the Hollywood movie industry can receive.
And how did Leonardo DiCaprio react backstage to finally getting his first Oscar?
Well, you know, he was clearly pretty excited. He took the opportunity to expand on the issue that he raised in his acceptance speech. He talked about global warming, and he says that while he was making this this film, The Revenant, he was also doing a documentary on global warming. And he sees The Revenant as kind of a story about man or humanity's relationship to nature. And this is an issue he was promoting, the fact that, you know, climate change is something that he believes governments have to get serious about addressing. So he spoke about that.
What is the feeling in Hollywood today about the performance of the Oscars host Chris Rock, an African-American comedian? How did the people think that he did in that role?
Well, people were watching very closely because, as you know, for the past month or so, there's been this controversy swirling around the Oscars in that for the second year in a row, there have been very few minority nominees. And especially in the acting categories, there were no non-white nominees. Now, in the directing category, we had, of course, the winning director from Mexico, who won for a second year in a row, Alejandro Iñárritu. But if you look at the whole collection of nominees, most of them are white. And so he had to address this issue, and he did it by attacking, you know, attacking the issue head on through his comedy routine, his monologue as he opened it up and joked about the Welcome to the White People's Choice Awards. And it was pretty clear that he had had some criticism from other people. There had been talk of boycotting the Oscars. Will Smith and his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, said they were boycotting.
Right, yeah. Chris Rock did push back against that idea of boycotting the Oscars. Now, what is the feeling about the Best Picture winner, Spotlight? How much of a surprise was that?
Well, that was a surprise. But, you know, these key awards, and the key awards are Best Picture, Best Director, and the key acting awards, often get split up. And so Iñárritu was the favorite director for The Revenant, but he was not a shoo-in for Best Picture. And the Spotlight was one of the films that was mentioned as a likely winner in that category, one of two or three that was at least a plausible winner. So people were surprised. There was a bit of a gasp when it was announced in the press room, but it was not that much of a surprise.
Yeah, and in fact, it only won two Oscars. Although they were among the most important Oscars, it also got a screenplay award. The film that got the most Oscars, Mad Max Fury Road, got six, but those are mostly technical. So I was just going to ask about some of the other categories, such as Best Documentary. We had a British film winning there about the late British pop star Amy Winehouse. How did the makers of that film react to the father of Amy Winehouse being so opposed to the movie?
Well, they were asked that, and they didn't respond directly, but they said they felt an obligation to portray Amy Winehouse fairly and in a positive light, and they say they think they did that. And basically they said, well, there is always going to be some criticism, but they didn't address it any more directly than that. They said they think they did a very fair job and portrayed her in a very positive light.
And what do you think is behind the win for Hungary of the Best Foreign Film category for Son of Saul?
Well, you know, that is a Holocaust film, and I think, you know, the Academy voters, there are about 6,000 members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and they tend to skew older, and, you know, these are people who, if they don't remember the Second World War directly, their parents were involved, and we've had a number of Holocaust stories that people have responded to positively over the years, like Schindler's List and The Pianist and Life is Beautiful. And I think if a film deals very well with this theme, it's likely to do well, and that's what we saw in this case.
And it's a movie that I hope to see as well sometime soon. Thank you so much to our correspondent at the Oscars, Mike O'Sullivan, for bringing us that report.
Thank you, Michael.
And that's it for International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Coca-Cola Company have announced support for a new program in Nigeria under the Water and Development Alliance, also known as the WADA Project. The $2 million project will provide up to 100,000 citizens in Cross River State with access to safe drinking water and good sanitation facilities by 2019. This joint investment is aligned with USAID and Coca-Cola's shared focus on clean water provision as a means to help build healthy, sustainable communities in Nigeria. The U.S. government is committed to engaging in effective and innovative alliances with committed partners to support Nigeria's critical development needs, said William Stoyer, acting U.S. Consul General in Lagos. We are proud to collaborate with Coca-Cola to bring a sustainable and safe water solution to thousands of people in Nigeria, he added. During the signing event, USAID Mission Director to Nigeria, Michael Harvey, said, "Today we are consolidating a special partnership, one in which a private firm has joined with a U.S. government agency to contribute to a priority set by the government of Nigeria." USAID and Coca-Cola have collaborated in Nigeria since 2007. The partnership has improved water resource management and expanded sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation services in Kano and in Yugu states. The WADA project helps to control and prevent water-related diseases such as cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea by providing water and sanitation services, hygiene education, and establishing water, environment, and sanitation committees in communities where the project works. This new agreement will provide a framework to implement WADA and to allow the parties to establish a range of policy issues to achieve their shared objectives in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with Nigeria and its international and private sector partners to give the Nigerian people better access to something all human beings need, safe drinking water.
That was an editorial.